Welcome, everyone, to this event, A Crisis of European Democracy. This is an event that forms part of a seminar series, Contesting Europe, a European Institute seminar series organized by Professor Damian Chalmers in law and myself. It also marks the book launch of a book, Blaming Europe, Responsibility Without Accountability in the European Union, written by James Tilley and myself. And as you'll see in a few minutes when James will be presenting the main findings, what this book does is try and address the state of democracy in the European Union by asking the question, how do people assign responsibility in such a complex system? And more importantly, how can they hold policymakers in the EU to account for the decisions that they think they're responsible for? What we find, as you'll hear, is that we think there's an accountability deficit in the European Union and declining levels of trust as a result. And we thought that the questions and conclusions raised by this book is a great occasion when we're now launching this book tonight to also bring together some leading scholars of electoral democracy in the European Union, who are all here with us, to talk about these broader issues of whether there's a crisis of European democracy today. We know, of course, that there are declining levels of trust in the European Union, declining levels of support for the EU, and that in the European Parliament elections coming up in May, Eurosceptic parties on the rise, populist parties on the rise. So on the one hand, we could see, well, that means that this is perhaps the most severe crisis facing the European Union in terms of popular legitimacy, that calls for radical reform, whether they be political union or repatriation of powers to the national level. On the other hand, you may think, well, this is just a healthy sign of democracy, giving the increasing attention to the EU, that the public is also reacting this way, and in fact that it could be a catalyst for something better, more popular engagement with EU politics. So we brought together these eminent speakers to give us a view on which of these views they think is more tenable. We hope we get some answers, although we might also get more questions. And I'd just like to briefly introduce our speakers. Ladies first, Catherine de Vries, who is Professor of European Politics at the University of Oxford and Fellow of Lincoln College, and has written extensively on public opinion and the role of EU issues in national and European politics. Mark Franklin, who is Emeritus Professor of the Emeritus Professor and the first inaugural chair, Stein-Rocken Chair at the European University Institute in Florence, and currently visiting professor at MIT in the US. And Claire de Vreese to the very left, who is Professor of Political Communication at the University of Amsterdam. And to my very left, James Tilley, who is University Lecturer at the University of Oxford and Fellow of Jesus College and also co-author of this book. So before James is going to introduce some of the findings and kick off this session tonight, I just want to say that we have a hashtag for this event, which is called LSE Blaming Europe. So I'm not on Twitter and don't really know how it works, but I do hope that by the end of this evening it will be trending in some way. And so with that, over to you, James, for starting this talk. And by the end, I should say that after the four interventions of this panel, there will be time for Q&A, as you can ask questions of all of us or some of us.
Oh, I see. Okay, thanks very much, Sarah. So I'd like to start this debate about EU democracy in crisis by talking about a couple of findings, and perhaps more importantly, the implications of those findings from our book, Hot Off the Presses, here. And in this book, more generally, we basically look at whether ordinary people think the EU is responsible for different kinds of policy areas, different kinds of policy outcomes, and also how the media and how politicians talk about responsibility in the EU and how that affects voters' views of responsibility. However, what I want to focus on is an argument we make in the final two chapters about accountability within the EU and how that's going to affect the future, basically, of the European project. So, in essence, we basically argue that people often hold the EU responsible for things, especially economic outcomes, but they find it very, very difficult to hold the EU accountable for those outcomes. And the upshot of that is really when things go badly, people can't sanction the incumbent government, can't vote against politicians that are responsible for those bad things happening. So rather that kind of blame and anger gets directed at the EU institutions themselves. So the crisis of democracy is therefore causing a kind of crisis of the European project, if you like. That's the kind of argument I want to make anyway. So first off, as Sara kind of preempted me a bit, it's not difficult to argue that the EU has been facing some pretty serious difficulties of late. There's a lot less support for membership of the European Union than there was. There's a lot less support for integration. There's a lot less support for enlargement than there was really only 5 years ago. Current predictions are Eurosceptic parties, that is parties that want their countries to withdraw from the EU, are going to get about a quarter of the vote, maybe even 30% of the vote in the May European parliamentary elections. Not surprisingly, that withdrawal support for the European project has also been accompanied by withdrawal of trust in the EU institutions themselves. Trust has fallen substantially since 2009. Only about a third now of people in the EU say they trust the EU institutions. Put those things together and what do you get? Well, you get less optimism about the EU's future at the same time. And if you ask people a question along the lines of are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the European Union, half people today say they're pessimistic, and that's doubled since the 2009 elections. So I think it's not unreasonable to say the EU's in crisis. The question really is, how did we get there? And for us at least, it's a kind of combination of bad economic news, responsibility laid at the door of the EU, and then the inability of voters to actually vote against a kind of incumbent EU government. So I think it's pretty uncontroversial to say times have been relatively tough of late. A quarter of young people across Europe are unemployed. Living standards have barely increased in the last 5 years in most countries. In some countries, not in the last 10 years. Government debt's nearly doubled. So things are bad. And when things are bad and things go wrong, people want to blame somebody for that, of course. And there's plenty of options in this case. We could blame ourselves. After all, it is everybody that borrowed too much money and invested it unwisely. People don't really like to blame themselves, of course, so they look for other options, particularly kind of unpopular, shady characters. And there's two obvious options there, one a couple of miles to the east in the city and one a couple of miles to the south in Westminster. And bankers and national governments definitely get the blame. Lots of people hold them responsible for the economic crisis. But I think what's interesting and different this time around, if you like, is that the EU also has been blamed. And it's really the first time that the EU has been such an obvious recipient of blame for economic conditions compared particularly to national governments. And that's particularly the case by the time we get to kind of 2012. So as the kind of financial crisis turns into the Eurozone crisis, we see increasingly people saying that the EU is at fault, it's the EU that's responsible. The graph on the left, these are graphs in the book, shows answer to the question who's most to blame for economic problems. And by 2012, there's a substantial minority of people in these kind of selected countries here that say the EU's to blame. On the other side, we've got blame for the financial crisis in Britain. You're allowed to list as many people as you want here to blame. And as I said, bankers, the national government get blamed, certainly. But by 2012, 4 out of 10 people in Britain are saying it's the EU that's responsible for the financial crisis, as many people as say the national government's responsible. So Europe's definitely getting increasingly blamed for economic problems. The real question is whether it's held accountable in any way. In general, when we think about national governments and economic performance, we do tend to think, and the literature tends to show, that governments are held accountable to some extent. Governments that preside over bad economic times, over poor economic conditions, tend to get kicked out of office, on average, at least. And I'll talk through this particular graph here. So if we just look at these middle two bars, the y-axis is an estimate of how much people support incumbent government parties. So basically, are you a supporter of the incumbent government party or not, roughly speaking? And then these bars represent the difference between people that think economic conditions are pretty good compared to people that think the economic conditions are pretty bad. So positive numbers here indicate that people who think the economy is going okay tend to support the incumbent government. And these are positive numbers, i.e. people who think the economy is going okay do tend to support the incumbent government, not surprisingly. The difference between these two bars is people that think the national government is mostly responsible for the economy and people that think the national government is not mostly responsible for the economy. And sensibly enough, again, people that think the national government is more responsible are more responsive to economic conditions, which is what we would presumably expect. Finally, and most interestingly from our point of view here, there's a big difference between the type of system you find yourself in and how much performance voting there is. So I've divided this into three groups. Over here we've got what are called high-clarity systems. High-clarity systems are basically where we have a single-party government. So normally in Britain, Britain would be a high-clarity system. And these estimates here are from data in 2009 across all EU countries, and about 7 or 8 EU countries then had a single-party government. In those systems, we see a lot of performance voting. Economic perceptions matter a lot for whether you support the incumbent party or not. These are low-clarity systems. Low-clarity systems are systems in which there are large, sprawling coalition governments with many parties in them that are often very ideologically incohesive. And those are systems where we don't see very much performance voting, where economic perceptions don't matter very much for whether you support the incumbent government, whether you go out and vote for the incumbent government or not. Which makes sense to some extent, I think. In systems where there's a single party, it's pretty easy to see who's cocked things up or occasionally got things right. You can vote for that party if they did well. You can vote against them if they didn't. In these kind of systems, where we've got large coalitions, multiple parties in power, it's much more unclear who is actually responsible. Is it reasonable to punish a party which only has 5 MPs, which is in the coalition? Did they really have any impact on the economic outturn or not? And more than that, in fact, complex governments like that, they often change composition between elections. So who actually was responsible if they were in power for a year or so, but then they weren't? I mean, are they part of that governing coalition that we should punish or not? And large grand coalitions, of course, make it even more difficult. There's very few alternatives to actually vote for. If most of the parties are actually in government, who do you actually vote against? So, broadly speaking, what we see, and some of Sarah and my other work has shown this, is that high-clarity systems, where the government's a single party, we find much more performance voting than we do in these low-clarity systems. Now, why am I banging on about this? What has this got to do with the EU? Well, our argument is that the EU is basically an extreme version of these low-clarity systems. In fact, while people hold the EU responsible for things, it's almost impossible for them to hold it accountable. As a brief aside, this is partially to do with low institutional clarity. It's unclear which bit of the EU institutional apparatus is actually responsible for what's going on. But more importantly, for us at least, it's due to low government clarity. There's not an obvious political party that you can punish at the polls when you go and vote that's responsible for the good or bad economic outturns. So while the European Parliament might aggregate national political parties into Euro parties within the Parliament, they don't really compete for power. When I go and vote in the EP elections, I don't vote for the European People's Party. I vote for one of the 40, I think, constituent parties that make up the European People's Party. Often more than two parties in the same country, obviously. There has to be. That means that I'm not actually really making a connection between the majority party in the European Parliament, which happens to be the European People's Party at the moment, and my actual vote choice in the European election. And in fact, it's even worse than that, because even if I did make the connection between my the political party I vote for in those European elections and the Euro parties within the European Parliament, most people would have absolutely no idea that the EPP is the largest party within the European Parliament. And in fact, 50% of people don't even know MEPs are directly elected. Yeah? So, I mean, given that level of ignorance, it's completely unreasonable to expect people to make any connection between European parliamentary vote choices and ultimately what happens in the European Parliament. So people can't reward, they can't punish EU politicians because there's no identifiable government and there's no identifiable governing parties. What does that mean? Well, as we show in the book, it basically means that people blame not parties, because they can't, they blame the institution itself. So people lose trust in the EU institutions when things go badly, and they lose trust in the EU as an institutional layer of government. So that might seem a bit of a grim conclusion for EU enthusiasts, including my co-author. but in fact, actually, it gets even worse. Because it's not just this is a problem, but it's a really difficult problem to solve as well. Improving institutional and especially government clarity is not obvious how we would go about doing that. Institutional clarity, well, I mean, the very notion, the very way in which the EU is set up embeds within it these overlapping competences, overlapping institutions. So to say that it's unclear which bit of the institution is responsible is right, because it is unclear. And to make that clearer doesn't seem a very easy way forward. Equally, improving government clarity would require EU-wide parties that competed on an EU-wide basis on EU-wide policy platforms. And then were seen within the European Parliament as governments and as oppositions. That seems a very unlikely outcome to me, at least, in the short term and probably in the medium and long term as well. But let's say I wave my magic wand and we manage to make those things happen. There's still another more perhaps fundamental problem with what's going on here, because for performance voting to work, for democratic accountability, at least in that sense, we need voters to agree on what kind of performance we're actually judging governments on. So if we turn to the US very briefly, there's plenty of evidence there that people judge the president on national economic performance. So when national levels of unemployment are high, they punish the president when it comes to a presidential election. When conditions in their state are bad, when unemployment's high in Kansas, if I live in Kansas, I punish the governor of my state. That's fine. That's accountability. But is that like the EU? Well, no, not really. Because it's very difficult to think that people care about levels of unemployment in neighbouring countries in the EU. Do I really care what the unemployment level is in France? Not really. It's got nothing to do with me. And in fact, to say that, do I care about the average level of unemployment in the EU as a whole? No, not at all. And unless people do that, then we can't really have performance voting, democratic accountability in that sense, within the EU. And inevitably, that means that as the EU is held increasingly responsible, that lack of basic accountability becomes more problematic. And this kind of one-size-fits-all model of European governance becomes more difficult to maintain. So my prediction of kind of Eurosceptic parties doing well in the May elections is not unusual. Most people, I think, would probably predict that they're going to do relatively well. But thinking about the mechanisms that perhaps underpin that increasing support makes me think, at least, that's not going to be a kind of flash-in-the-pan reaction to current bad economic tidings. It's going to be perhaps part of more of an increased and sustained opposition to further EU integration based essentially on this lack of democratic accountability. I'll finish there. Thanks.
Thank you so much, James. Now over to Catherine for perhaps a more positive
diagnosis. I think I was asked to give a more positive spin on this, so I will try to do my best, although probably I also end up somewhere. James couldn't have given me kind of a better step up to this, because my talk is called In Defense of Euroscepticism, it's all about the benchmark. James might be right about some things, but I think I'm going to argue it all depends, which is a cop-out for many academics to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. First, I want to spend some time to congratulate Sara and James on writing such a really thrilling book. I haven't read the original bit, but it proves. And I am in possession of a signed copy, so I'm particularly happy and today. The argument of the book I'm going to kind of talk about is this idea that James put forward, is that people assign more responsibility to the EU, yet electoral accountability is notoriously low, as James has told you in a very eloquent manner. And so the only way for citizens to signal discontent is by withdrawing support. And the evidence, I think, that they're building on, this is, for example, Eurobarometer survey data, which is the average or the percentage of trust in European Union institutions in the six largest countries, which make up about two-thirds of the EU population. And the blue bar is the May 2007, let's say, the pre-treatment, the Eurozone crisis, and then that's the orange bar, and then that's the blue bar. The orange bar is the post measurement, if you will, and that's in 2013, so the latest Eurobarometer, and what you see is a steady decline. A little bit different in certain countries, and that's what I'm going to focus on, is this kind of benchmark. What I want to talk about is the analysis about that input legitimacy is kind of the driver of this, or the lack of input legitimacy is the driver of this, is that, you know, really the problem? And should we be therefore as pessimistic as James invited us to be in some way? So this is kind of tagging along or dovetailing quite well with an ongoing debate of someone who is very known here, Simon Hicks, and Andrew Morawczyk. That's the person on the left. And this is the discussion about the democratic deficit. So Simon Hicks, I'll start with that, basically has the idea, yes, the EU is broke. The EU is broke on the basis of the lack of input legitimacy. There's no competition for the EU executive that leads to less involvement into the EU, and that's, you know, that needs to be fixed. So a lot of supranational solutions he proposes, for example, a directly elected commission president. He backtracked a little bit on that. Now it's having the European parliamentary groups having a leader that then becomes the commission president, something that people, well, we're not so sure what will happen after the EP election. It dovetails with an overall philosophical tradition, which I think didn't originate, weren't popularized with Alex de Tocqueville, that, you know, democracies need civic associations. They need some interest mediated competition of ideas, and that was also kind of popularized or revised more recently in the work of Robert Putnam, that what is, you know, lack of trust in government is something to worry about and something to be pessimistic about. And I think in that way, the end of the book Blaming Europe kind of takes on that idea. However, there's been another side to this story, and that's it ain't actually broke, and that's Andrew Morawczyk's article in defense of the democratic deficit. My title of the presentation is a bit of play on that, and his argument is actually that if electoral accountability ain't everything, you have a very strong European constitutional court, much stronger than we see in actually some, for example, the country that I'm from in the Netherlands, or actually this country that even doesn't have a constitutional court. And the way in which people can be, you don't need active involvement of people, or you don't necessarily only need electoral accountability, you need competing institutions rather than competing parties, if you will. And if there would be, probably Morawczyk would have to deal with the fact that EU policies have more redistributive outcomes today than they had in the time of his writing, but nonetheless, I think his solution to the problem would be to see more national empowerment than having supranational solutions. So seeking intergovernmental solutions, right, which might be not as problematic in order to solve. So rather than wanting to, I'm going to walk you through what I think your skepticism is originating of, or what it is and how it originates, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about how much should we worry about that. And at the end, I think I'm going to be a bit more reassuring than James and kind of say, well, maybe we should not necessarily worry so much about it. However, I think that even the Eurozone crisis has laid down a fundamental problem, and that's actually the north and south divide, or the core periphery divide. And that kind of is in line with what I argue, that actually Euroscepticism is what is crucial there. It's not necessarily that you don't dislike the EU, but it's always in reference, the yardstick or the benchmark we have nationally, something that also Andrew Rovcek says in his work on the democratic deficit, where he says, as if national institutions are working so well, right? So the idea of Euroscepticism in this kind of benchmark model would be that, well, why are people Eurosceptic? Well, they're Eurosceptic when staying in yields smaller or equal benefit compared to going out, right? Of course, the problem is that if people think in terms of utilities, what has this institution done for me, that people can't really know that. These are unknown quantities, right? So what do national publics do? They need to rely on benchmarks. So how good is my country faring in comparison to other member states? And that's actually the calculation that people are making, which is maybe not necessarily so much about input legitimacy, but much more actually about output legitimacy. Is this, you know, it's about international public good provision, and is this institution doing its job? Is it competent? Is it efficient? So which benchmarks would people use? Most literature will tell you, well, people are very kind of in the utilitarian model are economically interested, so it will be how well is my country's economy doing compared to other member states, right? So when that benchmark is positive, I say, well, the EU is actually doing something good for my country, but that's negative, it's the opposite, right? And that might be, of course, partly what's going on, as James also said, that in economic bad times, people withdraw support from the union. It's not just that, and that also links up a little bit with what with the book. But I wanted to kind of extend it a little bit more. People also use political or institutional benchmarks. So how high is the quality of government in my country compared to other member states? So for some publics, actually the EU might be a game, even though electoral accountability is low. Well, they are dealing with low state capacity and corruption in their own system. So if you're maybe from Greece, or if you, even though economically it's not going that well, you might still not necessarily withdraw support from the union. Or, for example, if you're Spanish, you still see that support for the EU is higher, or trust in the EU is higher than in their own governments. The last part is, well, and that's maybe, I come from a small country, so I'm Dutch originally, interested in, the last benchmark might be, well, how much influence does my country have in this big, this big state cooperative mechanism, or in this IGO, an international governmental organization? So how much influence does a country's political community have within the EU compared to other member states? So I'm going to walk you through and then trying to make an argument about reform at the end. So before I do that, I just wanted to show you, some of you may say, well, this is very rational, this is very kind of rational choice, do people really have real attitudes? This is just kind of to give you a sense of what's happened since the beginning of what we have kind of Eurobarometer data in 1973 to 2010. This is on the question, is membership or is your country's membership in the EU a good thing? And here you see a steady decline in people responding don't know to that question. Right? So interestingly, you see a little bit of a peak again in 2000 when it's around the euro, right? People don't necessarily know what the consequence of that would be, that they have to kind of see and what's going on. But overall, by 2010, people have quite good understanding of the EU, and I think also that was outlined in James' presentation. So thinking about an economic benchmark, here you see on the y-axis, this is from a full model, but anyway, the level of support for EU membership in percent, and then the economic performance benchmark, and just for you to kind of get a sense. So a minus means that your country's economy is doing worse than the EU average. A positive thing would be that you're above. So you see the expected direction, right? You see, as the benchmark of your country versus the rest of the member states, or the average of member states becomes better, you're more likely to support the union. So this idea about benchmarking. Some of you might say, this is in terms of economic growth, actually. Some of you might say, well, but that doesn't prove that people benchmark. Well, I can't show you in here, but this model predicts EU support better than a model just based on growth alone. So people, the yardstick information gives you a better prediction of EU support. So then thinking about the political benchmark, it's something that I think links up to kind of the it depends conclusion to Sarah and James' book, which I very much enjoyed, is if you make the differentiation between quality of government, so that would be state capacity and corruption, it's World Bank data, or the quality of government's indicators. So here you see two pictures. One is of quality of government high, above EU average, versus those where quality of government at the national level is low. And here I have trust in the EU, which is the blue line, and trust in national institutions, which is the red line. Interestingly, in these high quality government systems, you see maybe by 2013, you know, trust in the EU is lower than trust in national government, but overall it tracks pretty much together and it moves and crosses. You don't see that picture at all in low-quality government countries, right? Where the benchmark is that your own system is not doing that well. Here you see, you know, perfect slopes almost. It's a decrease in support, in trust, but it's equally for national governments than it is for EU institutions, but the EU is always rated better than your national institution, i.e. showing that, you know, it depends. Lack of electoral accountability might really depend on the system where you're from. The last thing is about this communal benchmark. So that is not just about kind of politics, you know, the institutions and the economy, but also the degree to which your country can wield power in this union. And here what I look at is, this is not this is the actual just growth, not the benchmark of growth. And to look if countries hold the council presidency, which is not necessarily something that's seen as so important, but especially in many countries outside of this country, it gets a lot of media attention and it's seen as an important role that a nation can play. And look at if possibly the national empowerment through the council presidency shields the EU from negative effects from economic performance. And this is exactly what you see, right? So you see, as economic performance is negative here, you see the lowest level of EU support, that's for all years, you know, it's much more difficult to see a clear pattern here for the presidency years. And also at the end of the time series, it looks exactly the same, right? But what you see is that negative performance, the EU shielded when the countries hold the presidency in those particular years. Kind of that idea of national empowerment. This idea of national empowerment is kind of also echoed in, if you look at the degree to which countries are able to get a national deal with Europe, right? Denmark is kind of the country that has the most opt-outs. Okay, or technically Britain will move into that category, but Denmark starts out with a very similar level of Euroscepticism as in the UK, and as it starts negotiating opt-outs after the Maastricht Treaty, it goes to a level that are close to the Netherlands, which is, you know, it's a country which seems partly very pro-EU. Of course, in recent years you see a drop again, but overall you see more support than lack of support. And not only did that happen in Denmark, you had more national empowerment by increasing scrutiny of national parliaments and legitimizing their governments when they go into the council. So, what would be my verdict on Euroscepticism? Is the citizen connection lost, and how skeptical should we be of skepticism? Well, maybe we should not be as skeptical. Maybe this is a sign of maturation. People hold real attitudes. Collective EU preferences are a function of national benchmarks. They move in quite predictable ways, and the response to real-world conditions. I think that's what we want from collective preferences. Is the recent rise due to economic bad times exacerbated by the lack of electoral accountability? I wouldn't disagree with that at all. But I would want to make kind of an argument that it depends. It depends on your national benchmark and on which country you reside. Will then support bounce back in the future? Sorry, bounce is written wrongly, sorry. In economic good times, most likely yes. However, the level of that really depends on your national benchmark. I don't necessarily think with that. Maybe if Britain negotiates a lot of opt-outs, support might go up, but I don't necessarily think that, you know, people are going to rally around Europe. But if the economy goes better, I think you see, my prediction will be that trust or support will increase. Is Euroscepticism now a problem? Moving back to that kind of Moravcek-Hickshean. Well, not per se. And actually, interestingly, the finding that national empowerment increases support is partly at odds with our current debate, which is really about supranational reform solutions, right? About elected commission presidents and all these things. Actually, in the time that the European Parliament became more powerful, it raised expectations, right, about electoral accountability. It couldn't live up to it. So maybe what we should try is a more intergovernmental route to some of this, empowering national parliaments, thinking about EU Senate, other reforms. Then, Catherine, really, don't you think there's anything to worry about, you know, when trust really trust or your skepticism goes down? Well, one last point I wanted to make, and hopefully I have some time still, but that in the Eurozone crisis, we saw kind of a manifestation of a split between between the core and the periphery. So just one last thing. I think that there's not a problem of legitimizing a two-speed Europe, but legitimizing a two-class membership. You see the southern periphery, the eastern periphery, not liking Merkel, not liking the movement that the EU is heading in, whereas the Netherlands and Germany and Sweden, small countries where they think their interests align with Germany, pork from Germany will trickle back to their economies, trust in Germany's leadership in the union is quite high. So, sorry, taking a little bit too much time, but this is what I wanted to say.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Mark Franklin, please.
Okay, it's this one, isn't it? Okay, this is not actually a cardiogram, but it looks enough like one that I think I can use it as a teaser for my talk. My topic addresses why, despite the blame heaped on European institutions and governments over the past 4 years, why we still see considerable, perhaps even sufficient, support for the European project. This support is in many ways a puzzle. A project that depends utterly on public support has been subject to so much bad news that one might have expected support to have entirely evaporated, but it has not. One reason, I'm going to argue, is because there is in most European countries a reservoir of what David Easton once called diffuse support for the European project. I'm going to illustrate this with reference to a question asked every 6 months in the EU's Eurobarometer. Do you think your country's membership in the European Union is a good thing, a bad thing, or neither good nor bad? In 2011, the proportion answering good thing dropped below 50%, and the Brussels bureaucrats responsible for planning the EB decided to stop asking the question. Much of what follows comes from a presentation that I gave in Brussels in June 2012, whose object was to persuade those Eurocrats that shooting the messenger was a really bad idea, and that reinstating the question would enable us to study effects of the crisis on public opinion. My efforts bore fruit, but only briefly. The question was asked one more time, and then once again abandoned. So what I'm giving you today is a very simplified presentation of an investigation that is actually much more sophisticated and takes place at the national level. I'm looking at all 12 of the countries that have been members of the EU since 1985, but what I'm telling you about now is the average. Here's that average, the percentage saying membership is a good thing over time. As you see, it bounces around 60%, sometimes above, sometimes below, but seemingly coming back to this point after straying away from it. And notice that this is the percentage saying good thing. There are three categories here, good thing, bad thing, neither good nor bad. The percentage saying good thing is hugely greater, even today, than the percentage saying that it's a bad thing. So maybe there's what we might call an equilibrium level of support that this series comes back to time and again after it has been pulled away by a shock to the system. What do I mean by shock to the system? Do I have that? Yeah, all right. What I mean by shocks to the system, I mean events that are taken note of by ordinary people and that affect the answers they give the next time they're asked the question about their country's membership. Events like the Single European Market Act, the Project 1992, the Maastricht Treaty, the mad cow disease crisis, or the current financial crisis, these are shocks. These are events that move public opinion. Public opinion notices these things and thinks either better or worse of the EU as a result. So how would we know whether there's indeed a long-term equilibrium? One way is by using the tool that I called an electrocardiogram and showed you in the initial slide. I'm going to ask you to bear with me as I explain how that tool works and what it tells us about the mainsprings of public opinion change. This one is the first of two pictures that I want to step you through. If you understand the differences between them, you'll understand everything else I have to say. They're graphical depictions of two ideal type ways in which shocks to the system might affect public opinion. As we move from left to right across the first graph, we're moving forward in time. So time's going that way. At various points, we see shocks represented by vertical lines with arrows at the end, upwards for a positive shock that increases satisfaction with membership, downwards for a negative shock. This top graph supposes that the shocks are ephemeral, that after any change in public attitudes, a long-term equilibrium is immediately restored. The arrows indicate that public opinion changes, but support immediately comes back to where it started from. I call this the journalist model because the evening news only ever mentions the events of the day. To newscasters on the evening news, yesterday and tomorrow don't exist. There's just today. The next graph supposes that there's no long-term equilibrium at all, or, if you like, that each shock creates a new long-term equilibrium. So each arrow, which is exactly the same length as in the first graph, leaves support at a new position. It moves, the first arrow moves support up, the second arrow moves support down, the third arrow and fourth and fifth moves it further down. We call this a random walk. I call it the bureaucrat's model because it's evidently what those bureaucrats feared when they suppressed the question about support for Europe. They thought, my God, it's going through the floor, it'll never come back, we better just hide the evidence. So in the next slide, I repeat the second of these pictures and add a third ideal type that I want you to compare with the second. The third ideal type is what happens when there's some propagation of the shock forward in time. It's not 100% as in the previous slide. It's not 0% as in the slide before that. It's somewhere between 100 and 0. And what we see are arrows followed by slopes. The slope is the support trending back towards the mean. If you get another arrow before it reaches the mean, you get a new position from which it trends towards the mean again. So these two are particularly important examples. This one's trending down because it's above the mean. This one's trending up because it's below the mean. I call this the economist's model because economic theory is based on the notion of long-term equilibrium. But my story sees this long-term equilibrium as evidence that there is, in fact, diffuse support. I see diffuse support as a behavioral phenomenon, not as what we can measure in answer to a question, but the way that question, the way those answers evolve over time. So, which is the true picture? You know, which of these three things actually tells us what is going on? Well, here we are back at the heartbeat. This is what econometricians call a chorogram. Or correlogram. It shows us what is the pattern of propagation in our time series. What we see is that we've got readings every 6 months. After the first 6 months, 80% of the original shock is left. 6 months later, 80% of 80% is left. 6 months later, 80% of 80% of 80%. Mm. It takes 10 time periods for that to reach zero. 10 6 month periods is 5 years. You get back to equilibrium after 5 years elapsed. What are the shocks that might give rise to this pattern of order correlations? There are quite a lot of candidates, but just three types of shock prove enough to explain the fundamental movement in the series. These are... We start, as I said, in 1985, because that's when Spain and Portugal joined the EU. That's from there on I have a series. I can't do it before that. And the first of shock that we find that is actually producing a significant effect is Project 1992. I don't know how many in this room are old enough to remember Project 1992, probably about four. but it was the most successful public relations exercise in the history of the EU. Every European household received a package through the mail. And evening news was amazingly, day after day, reporting the horse race of whether we were going to manage to complete the single market by 1992. Oh, today it's looking good. Oh, today it's looking terrible. Look, they failed to pass this. Oh, but now they've passed that. You know, we're going to get there. And it was absolutely amazing what this did to support for Europe. Look at how the series goes up and peaks at the end of 1992. After that, it declines, naturally, because there's no more good news, and that decline is enhanced or magnified by that wretched mad cow crisis where the Brits, of all people, exported contaminated beef to the French. Oh, mon Dieu! and, you know, genuinely, an awful lot of people started to worry about whether their children were going to be affected for their lifetimes by this shock, by this food. And Europe came under considerable criticism for having allowed this to happen. After that, what we seem to see is a general return towards the line of equilibrium, which then, you know, goes to hell at the time of the Eurozone crisis. So we actually looked at a lot of candidates. The three asterisk ones are the three that appear on the previous slide. They're the only three that were significant. You know, the others are all things that people say, well, what about this? What about that? Yeah, well, what about them? They have effects, but not big ones. This is how it works. Project 1992 comes along, lots of publicity, nice glossy package through the door, and boom, up goes support for Europe, and starts to decay again almost immediately. But before it's decayed very far, a second boom, as the evening news starts giving these horse race results. And those two together are added, so you get that first peak that we saw. Then, just as those are declining towards nothing, we get the mad cow crisis, which pushes it down, after which nothing much happens. The equilibrium comes back. We start moving back towards the equilibrium until in 2009 and 2010 we get these last two shocks. And look what we get when we add those together. We get a prediction that looks extraordinarily like the first opinion series that we started with. And look how the two fit together. You know, the ups and downs are, in general, very similar, even if there are peaks and troughs that don't exactly match. The long-term equilibrium is given by this constant term in the equation. We were very close when we said about 60. It's actually 61. Or if I use the individual countries and weight by population, it comes out at 62. No. Not very different. And each of the shocks that was significant produces a 7-point shift, either positive or negative. That's just coincidence. I mean, it just so happens that they're all 7%. Well, of course, they're not exactly 7.7%. They're 7-point-something or 6-point-something. But they average out to 7% each, which is absolutely remarkable. So, there's an equilibrium level of support for Europe. shocks move support away from this equilibrium, but those shocks decay. And on the basis of this analysis, our prognosis for the outcome of the current crisis is actually rather positive. You know, once the bad news stops, hey, when is the bad news going to stop? The equilibrium level of support for the European project should be restored within 5 years, as long as that heartbeat is still strong. Of course, things might go wrong, but there's no particular reason to suppose that they will. This seems to be a feature of the data. What we find is, therefore, that the question wording is not the important thing. What matters is how the series behaves. So let's come back to this cardiogram. Oops. No, that was supposed to be... Okay, so we can do it this way. There we go. View. Full screen. So we come back to this cardiogram, which to my way of thinking is the healthy heartbeat of maybe an athlete that's broken a couple of legs. You know, that athlete will recover as long as the heartbeat is there. What we really have to worry about is what would happen if that heartbeat were to stop. And at that point, I will stop.
Thank you, Mark. Last but not least, Professor Claes de Vreese, please.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here at LSE with such a nice crowd of students of European integration and who are interested in these matters to celebrate the launch of this very good book and being on such a panel. I feel kind of almost it's ironic. I'm Danish by origin, and for many years I've sat on panels where I was always representing the country with the odd opinion, being the Eurosceptic country, having to explain what was up with Denmark and why they were so different. Well, as history has evolved, I work in the Netherlands and here I am in London, and I think I'm now representing the country with almost the most positive EU attitude at this point in time. That's interesting, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. I want to make 3 points in addressing the question of whether or not we are in a state of crisis at the current times in terms of democracy in the EU. Of course, there will not be a definitive answer after these 3 points, but I think that they are three important points. The first one is that over the past 5 years during the economic recession and crisis, something very interesting has happened that has highlighted a very important thing, namely the crucial role that national politicians play for EU politics and for our understanding of whether or not there's an EU deficit, a democratic deficit. It is almost ironic that over the course of the time where we see the aggregate level dwindle, whether it comes back up or not, remains to be seen. But in those years, our terminology in terms of thinking about EU's affairs have changed dramatically. The semester system, banking unions, troika, rescue packages. These were words that did not really exist in our active vocabulary and not when we were talking about European Union. And the interesting thing is, of course, that all of this has been decided in the indirect way in the EU. These have been ministers of finance, and the prime ministers of Europe that have come together and have come up with ad hoc solutions to severe problems. This is in contrast to the entire discussion of the role of the parliament, its increased powers, its increased oversight, its co-legislation power, etc., etc. And it puts the spot on national politicians as an extremely important intermediary between the EU level and national public opinion. These national politicians were the ones who negotiated the packages. They were also the ones at home who either decided to take credit when things looked well or to give blame when they looked less well. They are incredibly important for understanding whether or not that there is a democratic deficit or not. If national elections were all about European issues, you could say, well, this worked fine, Moravec is right, we'll hold them accountable at national elections. Did we like the package the way it worked out? We vote them out of the office. And yes, there are elections from the past 5-year period, where Europe did play a role. But nonetheless, it is all about how these national politicians come back and also take responsibility or not take responsibility for what, at the end of the day, were their own deeds. That's observation number one about to assess whether or not there's a crisis in democracy. There's a crucial role here for the national level. Second point, Eurosceptic sentiments are probably not as easy as they look. Much of what we know in terms of public opinion and EU attitudes is based on the Eurobarometer, and unfortunately even there we are let down sometimes by the availability of data. But if we go a little bit beyond membership assessments and the assessment of whether or not you think that your country's membership to the Union is a good thing or a bad thing, the picture also gets a little bit more blurred, and that is interesting and important at the same time. We've done research that have tried to look at different types of dimensions of EU attitudes, and interestingly, if we compare some of these scores that we have in these different dimensions from 2009, when the crisis was still pretty much a crisis that evolved in the US housing market and had not yet become a full-blown euro crisis, and compared that to 2013, we see some interesting things. Looking in this instance at Dutch data, the level for membership support has actually not changed all that much. The EU is still seen as a vehicle for peace and stability in the continent. The popular take on that was, that's still true, but not sufficient. But where do we see a big decline in our numbers? We see that in whether or not the Dutch think that the EU is functioning according to democratic principles and whether or not it's transparent. And if you think about the first point, all these decisions being taken, important, urgent, unknown situations, but also very murky in terms of decision making and in terms of being able to hold people accountable, there is actually maybe some light at the end of the tunnel in terms of seeing citizens that make a relatively correct adjustment of what has happened over the past 5 years, that yes, integration processes that have happened at a very high pace were not particularly transparent, and it was rather hard for your average citizens to judge that and hold anyone accountable. So that's the observation number two, that Eurosceptic attitudes are probably more multidimensional than we tend to look at them oftentimes also given the nature of the data that we have, because if we have different questions that pertain not only to the utilitarian dimension, not only to whether or not you think that membership is a good thing, but also holds a performance assessment dimension, whether or not you think the Union is doing a good job, whether it is operating according to democratic principles, I think you start seeing different things, and we might actually start seeing citizens making judgments that many would say are not completely irrational, and that's always a good thing. Third point that I want to make about the crisis or not. It would be a truism to say that the EU as an arena will be populated by those who take an initiative. It sounds almost too much of a truism, it sounds banal, but nonetheless it's the case. The topic of European integration has of course moved from being a consensus issue in many countries with very little public debate, very little media scrutiny of what was going on, to being a contentious issue in many places. We know from our data, where we've looked at media coverage over the past 15 years in the Union, that media do pay attention to issues of European integration, and they do so particularly when elites disagree with one another. If they row over issues, if they have different opinions, if they want to make sure that the electorate has a choice in terms of the direction that the Union should move, that's when you see the media paying attention, and that's when you see a public debate taking place. Now, that's an important observation, because in many countries it has been quite comfortable for many political parties to not talk so much about the EU affairs. It was kind of pleasant if it wasn't too visible in the national political arena. But now we're in a state where, as James mentioned, the polls are looking that somewhere between one quarter and one third of the votes for the European Parliament elections in May could go to parties who in various degrees oppose not only further integration, but perhaps even the level of polity and all its institutions together. And here's a big question. Is that then a good thing or a bad thing? Well, the observation was the stage will be taken by those that take an initiative. And many middle ground parties and centrist parties in Europe today have decided quite deliberately in the past years not to take a position on issues of European integration, but they will be forced to, or they will lose dearly in these European elections that are coming up. But answering the question whether that is a crisis of democracy, I'm not so sure it is. You could also interpret that as quite a vibrant democracy, that the parliament has better and broader representation than it has had before. So with these three questions or observations, I did not provide an answer to the question of whether or not there was a democracy, but that the levels of, say, national politicians and understanding the public sentiment on whether or not there's actually support for European integration or not, and whether it has different dimensions or not, and the prediction that it is those with the initiative that will trumpet and win in May. I will hand it over to you again, Sarah. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for these four excellent interventions. I don't know if we have exactly come to a consensus on whether or not there's a crisis of European democracy. I think I'm glad to hear that I think you all agree with our book that there is an accountability deficit, but the question is perhaps, well, is that really a problem if we have declining trust and Euroscepticism? I mean, perhaps we don't even have declining trust, perhaps it's just a blip.
It would be a huge problem if we didn't have declining trust, because it would mean nobody was playing the slightest bit of attention to what was going on.
So critical citizens.
So people are critical, and is that just as Claes was saying at the end, that's a vibrant sign of democracy, or is it something slightly more sinister than that that we should worry about, or that politicians should worry about? So with that, I would like to open the floor for your questions. Perhaps you want to probe a bit. So I'll take a round of questions, and if you could just, before you ask the question, if you could just introduce yourself briefly with your name and your affiliation.
Thank you. My name is Ramesh Shukla. Europe certainly suffers from democratic deficit. But where does, what is the, I mean, where is the origin of where, what you call, where do we lay the blame for this democratic deficit? On the European institutions or on the people? After all, we had a very poor representation, the poll for European elections have been very, very low. In this country, something like about 30% or odd. I would like to know how other European countries are performing. I mean, the polling in European elections is how high it is. So what I have to ask you, this democratic deficit, who is it because? Is it because of people themselves? So, and if it's because of people, what can we do about it? Thank you.
Thank you. That's a question here.
Hi, thank you very much. Well, my name is Sergi Pardos from the University of Oxford, and a big fan of the authors of this book, and very interested in some of these things. I was wondering, is there any possibility in these items that I do not remember very well now, but these items that try to capture to which extent people feel the EU responsible of things, is there any possibility that some respondents, especially, you know, less knowledgeable, less interested, especially in some more, in some countries more than others, is it possible that these people are not actually judging the EU as a polity, like what the European Commission and the European Parliament do and all this, but they are just using that word as a heuristic of some European states. They actually think, they actually have Merkel in mind when having the European Union. They just understand Europe, right? Because if the answer is no, they really understand that this is European Union, I would be inclined to agree with Mark and to some extent Catherine's interpretation that maybe this is not such a bad thing. Like, actually, they understand that polity is responsible for something, right? Which is something that actually we thought it was not the case. So they at least acknowledge the existence of a polity and they attribute some responsibility, right? But if the answer is, yeah, maybe they don't know, then the implication is completely the opposite, right? So to which extent there's room for this suspicion, and how could we disentangle that? Thank you.
Thank you, Sergio. And there's a question here.
Thank you very much. My name is Sana Musharraf, and I'm a student here in the Law and Accounting program doing my master's degree. I'm a non-European, but very much interested in what's been happening, or because Europe is, I'm a business student, so Europe has a key role to play in the global economy. What perturbs me as a student or from a business perspective is the fact that though the objective of the euro was to have a single market, however, each market needs to be governed. And in terms of the European Union, how is it, or where is this structure frail? Because each country has its own legislature, and from an economist's perspective, fiscal discipline in the presence of a monetary union, that's something which perturbs me. I just wish to know or learn from your wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and just a final one here, and then we take some responses. The gentleman with the glasses there.
Yeah, Keith Raffin. I'm a former member of parliament, but the point about it is that in all the polls we have here, Europe is far down in people's concerns. And in fact, the European elections, parliament elections on the same day as local elections, to confuse matters even further. And to confuse matters even further beyond that, the poll of UKIP supporters and UKIP voters actually shows that their main concern is not Europe, but immigration. So despite all these very impressive graphs and polls, though I'd love to know the samples, I'd like to know the samples in individual countries, etc., etc., I mean, that's what we face here, is actually, you know, getting people actually to vote in Europe, to think about Europe as important. It's probably going to be, actually, in many ways, more likely that after the European Parliament elections, Europe as an issue will maybe be more important in the Scottish referendum campaign than it will actually be in the lead up to the European Parliament elections.
Okay, thank you. We'll take some responses to that.
I'll take the first one.
Okay.
Whose fault? Okay, that's a really great question, and I've been banging this drum for 30 years. You know, Europe was built by a bunch of technocrats with the acquiescence of our national politicians, whom we elected again and again without paying very much attention to what they were doing. And Europe provided those politicians with cover when things went wrong. Politicians were repeatedly able to say, oh, that wasn't me, that was Europe. And the Europe that they had constructed didn't have anybody who could reply. I mean, there is no figurehead in Brussels who can say, no, that's a lie. We didn't do that. You did that. Or, yeah, the Council of Ministers agreed to that, and your vote was... No, we don't get that kind of truth-telling from Brussels, and if we did, we wouldn't know about it, since there's no press corps in Brussels, and what happens in Brussels is only reported, to the extent that it is, through... in Britain, a British lens, in France, a French lens, and so forth. So I think the major problem is that those who put this union together, and of course remember that when they started, they were not putting together a political union, they were putting together a coal and steel club. You know, it grew beyond all imagining. And when they put it together, they were not thinking in terms of its democratic credentials or the ways in which it might be held accountable by European voters. Those problems, just like the problems of the euro, created need for add-on institutions. The European Parliament is the most obvious of the add-on institutions, you know, coupled together in order to try to give an apron of legitimacy to the system. And European elections were an add-on, you know, carefully devised so as not to provide voters with any real control over what was going on. Now, this is great for the politicians. It's absolutely terrible for the long-term prospects of European survival. So despite my optimistic prognosis of a few minutes ago, I actually do think we have a major institutional problem on our hands, which shows almost no sign of being addressed.
Okay, thank you, Mark. James?
Yeah, on the first and last questions, I guess, I'll perhaps take those together quickly. I mean, turnout's very low in these elections generally, but, I mean, why wouldn't it be? They have no impact and they have no implications, so you'd be kind of a bit crazy to go and vote in them. And in that sense, they're second-order elections. Yeah, people are voting against or, you know, they want to give the national government of the day a kicking. They're not interested in what's going on in Europe. And I guess that's our point, yeah? They have no implications. They don't matter. They're not holding EU politicians to account. They're not really holding national politicians to account, other than the press coverage is a bit negative if the national government of the day doesn't do very well. And then on Serge's point, yeah, I mean that's a good point. Probably there are a lot of non-opinions on this, as all kind of political opinions. Most people aren't very interested in politics and they don't have very strong opinions about things. Having said that, it is the case that if we look at perceptions of responsibility, say, for things like interest rates, then there are clear differences across countries that are in the Eurozone, and they say, yeah, the EU is responsible for interest rates, whereas people outside the Eurozone don't, which is reassuring, yeah? People have got some conception of responsibility, maybe not with the precise institution within the EU, and on that, I think you're right, but then I'm not sure I have a precise idea of which institution in the EU is responsible for lots of different things. So it'd be unreasonable to expect the ordinary voter to do that. So I think there's probably some non-attitudes, but on the other hand, I think there's some matching up to reality, which is kind of reassuring that there's something there.
And just following up on that, you were sort of implying, Soti, that do we think it's a bad thing that people hold the EU responsible? No, we don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, it's a reflection of that the EU has growing influence for things that have, to a large extent, not gone very well. So we don't think that's a bad thing. We think that means that people pay attention and increasingly pay attention. That's also to the gentleman's question of, well, people don't care about the EU. What we're seeing increasingly across Europe is, no, people do care about the EU when the EU matters. People do pay attention, and it does matter also in national elections. What we are saying is a bad thing. It's not that they are blaming Europe, but that they're blaming Europe and have no outlet for their blame. So they know there's this level of government that partly decides what's going on in terms of austerity policies and so on, but what is the outlet? If you know it's not your national government, but you know it's partly dictated in Brussels, whether it's, you know, the exact institution is irrelevant, but you don't have an outlet for that. So it's the accountability deficit, we think, is the root of this problem, rather than the fact that Europe is being blamed.
Yeah, to link up to the question about the economy, I think also actually in some ways to Sergio's question, I think I'm going to say it depends, of course, but I think it's a crucial question. Is it about the actors, right, who are being blamed, which, you know, in some ways is kind of the last graph about Merkel, or is it the policy as such? And that has very different ideas about how we think about this problem. And I think what has happened is, of course, that the economic shocks were asymmetric shocks, right? So they hit the core in a different way than they hit the periphery. And that is something that was already there, right? But Zapatero, at a certain point, was very, very happy and said, you know, we joined the Champions League of Europe when they joined the Euro, right? And that, of course, was a kind of a crude awakening how Germany dictated, Germany and others dictated the bailout packages. And in some ways, I think what for me is a challenge for the European Union, maybe not so much much of EU scholars talk about the legitimate, you know, how you can legitimize two speeds of Europe, but how are you going to deal with two classes of membership? And the two classes of membership is really about the South, especially the South, I think, feeling that they're not part of the club, right? So the pork of Germany is not going to trickle down to their economies. And it's absolutely in no interest of the core to redistribute to the periphery. And they know that, right? So the question is, what do you do then? And then I think if you think about the benchmark that they have nationally, i.e. Spain, take for example, a quite corrupt government, and economic performance that ain't good either, and then a large country but not wielding the power in Europe, you don't have a national resort either, right? The UK at least has the idea many people are quite, or at least, you know, wouldn't be unhappy being outside the Union. I don't think Spaniards would be happy about that. So that, I think, is really something that could create alienation, and that could also be a real challenge for the Union in years to come.
Clint, do you have...
on the first question of turnout and who is to blame. Is it stupid politicians, stupid media, stupid citizens, or stupid institutions, or a little bit of all? There's absolutely a lot of mileage in the argument that the institution of the parliament and its elections was ill-conceived to start with. But the paradox and the catch-22 of that situation, that it takes national politicians and national leaders to fix this, and they have no interest in doing so. So there's a long shot for fixing the institutional deficit there in order to increase turnout and make the parliament, if that were the chosen option, to be a more central player. Other than that, you see what happens typically, namely that media and politicians like to blame each other. Politicians generally think that it's the fault of the media, and the media will say, well, if you had something interesting to say, we would report about it. And interestingly, there is a bit of truth to that in the sense that if we look across the union and across time, there really is more coverage of, for example, EP elections in those countries where the elites tend to disagree and where the movement and the level of disagreement is also increasing over time. That simply generates more media attention and more debate, even at the individual level, being exposed as a citizen to that type of news coverage about the EP election and accidentally bumping into a news story. Britain is the odd case out here, but accidentally bumping into a news story that shows you that the parties may actually want different things for these EP elections is beneficial for turnout. But the blame game is a rather traditional one here, but that we know that media are extremely responsive to supply, and when there is something which is not a consensus to report on, they will.
So you will have noticed that five political scientists up here avoided the question about what does it take to govern a single market. So that's because it's five political scientists, five economists. But of course, is relevant.
I did mean to be addressing that.
Oh, apologies. But of course, so that's probably why that you probably better ask some of our colleagues in the Economist Department if you want a really good answer to that excellent question. But I'll just open up the floor for a last few couple of questions, if there are any. There's one up here.
Hi, thanks, Jonathan White from the LSE. Attributions of responsibility, I guess, always particularly interesting when they're coupled with a sense that those who did something could have done differently. In other words, a kind of attribution of moral responsibility rather than causal responsibility. Is there are such distinctions identifiable in the data that you're using, and to what extent could you say that the citizen responses that you're looking at are more of the sort of moral responsibility rather than causal responsibility kind? I think it's probably quite significant for how one thinks about questions of critical citizens versus simply sceptical citizens. Thanks.
And there's a question here.
Thank you. David Spence, visiting fellow at the European Institute. I think my question is rather like the last question or links into it, and that is, listening to all of you and looking at the book, which I haven't read yet, what we're dealing with, or what you are dealing with here, is people's perceptions. That, you know, they blame Europe, or they don't blame Europe, or they blame their own government, or they don't blame their own government. And that's interesting, because it's about their perceptions, but it isn't really about facts. I mean, except that the fact that it is their perception. And I wonder whether there is anything in the book or in your minds about whether they are right or not. In other words, have they got it wrong because they don't understand the European Union? And is there any correlation between the real competences of the institutional setup, not the individual institutions, but of the institutional setup, and what they believe? Because if in the end it's all perception, well, that's fun, but not really important.
There's a question here. Damien Chalmers, front row.
Damien Chalmers from the LSE. My question is really a little bit to ask James and Mark, maybe to come back on Catherine's point. And my question is, what I'm getting at is that, as I understood both of you, you're arguing for a general equilibrium. In one case, a resettlement of the equilibrium, a less positive view of the EU than previously. And my question is, does territorial variation matter at all in this? The fact that different states Do they oscillate more? Does sectoral variation matter, that the EU does different things for different states than for others? And does temporal variation matter at all, in the sense that the EU, both territorially and in terms of policies, is just unrecognisable from what it was 15 years ago, if you looked at the acquis of the, if you looked at performance, for example?
Thank you, Damien. And just a final question, the lady with her hand up there in the back.
You can take a second.
Thank you. My name's Kat, and I'm a writer from the United States. And then what I, as a EU enthusiast, I don't know, I think a lot of Americans are, cheering for Europe. What I take from today is actually things that I think are more positive than I came in hoping to hear, because my question essentially is it really there a crisis? Because in the States, we'd like to say, comparing to what? If we are thinking about national benchmark, I'm thinking about, of course, my own country. Another thing, if you look at the approval rating, say, at any given moment, maybe right now, like President Obama or the Congress especially bad, like people liken to the support for O.J. Simpson, like even lower than that. So I've been thinking, if we use a national benchmark, if people, individual country, member country, is not doing well, then they have higher opinion of the European Union, or when they are doing well, they do not have any reason to leave or to doubt or to criticize. And I'm just wondering, and I'm of course looking at Ukraine, people will even risk something like a revolution to get closer to European Union. So I'm just wondering if it's a rather pessimistic, or because equilibrium of a 60 to 62% is just amazing. High from, say, American perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll answer now, respond here before, and there will, if there are more questions, we have a reception afterwards, so we can do it there. I think there were some more concrete, specific questions about the items and the books. I think we'll take them first, and then more general responses. So
I'll let Sara speak mainly, but I mean, just quickly on the point here about, is it factually, does it mean anything? I guess what's interesting, I think it's two points. One is people's perceptions matter in the sense that they then inform what they go do in terms of voting and things like that. So I think in that sense it's important. We also conducted an expert survey of political scientists around Europe and asked them where they thought responsibility lies in various different policy areas. To be honest, they didn't do a particularly good job of matching up to what at least we kind of came up as the factually accurate portrait of what goes on, apart from interest rates or something relatively straightforward like that. Because not only, and that's two reasons, the overlap between national and EU governance, who really knows who's responsible? It's really difficult to tell. And then the overlap between the institutions, because we asked the experts to identify which institutions were actually responsible for things. I mean, people didn't really have a clue. And these are people lecturing in EU politics. So you've got to think, therefore, that to some extent, to expect anything like that of voters is kind of insane.
But just to be the more positive, the good cop in this bad cop, good cop co-authorship, because I entirely agree with your point that if it's just sort of perception that have no root in reality, you know, is it that interesting? And it might be interesting because in a democracy, even perceptions that have no foundation still matter. But what we found, and perhaps surprisingly, I think we came into this project with an open mind. Can people make some sense of how they're structured? And we find that the context does structure. When the EU takes on more powers, people respond to that in certain areas. Cross-national variation, you know, going to Damien's question, matters for how people perceived responsibility. Changes over time when the crisis take on matter. So there is some structure to it. It's not entirely random, but it is also shaped by people's what we might call biases about the EU. So if you don't like the EU and things are going badly, you're going to blame the EU a lot more. If you like the EU and things are going badly, you're going to think probably it's the bankers or the national government. So there are biases, but it's not random attitudes. Just also in that, what are these perceptions measuring to Jonathan White's question, is it functional or causal responsibility? Well, Of course, these things are not entirely, you know, you can't entirely separate them. But what we try to, with the questions that we had designed in this cross-national survey to tap into is functional responsibility or role responsibility. In other words, which institution is responsible for this and therefore ought to deliver, not whether or not do they do a good or a bad job with it. The reason for focusing on that primarily is, of course, that is a condition for whether or not you can then have causal responsibility. You have to first have the responsibility for then to do a good job or bad job with it. Another reason for focusing on that is, of course, if you ask them whether you've done a good job or a bad job, you're basically getting an answer to is the EU a good or a bad thing. So it's primarily the former, but these two things in people's minds, although, you know, philosophically there's, and conceptually you can separate them in people's minds, these things are interrelated. So I just wanted to, you know, address these more specific questions about the book, and also to Damien's. Yes, we do find that these things are shaped by variation geographically, whether or not, depending on the level of responsibilities that EU has for specific things, that varies depending on others, and temporarily looking across the crisis, there are responses in line with that. But then I'll just give the word to the rest of the panel to respond to some of the more general questions. If you have anything you'd like to add.
Can I pick up on territorial variation very quickly? There's huge variation in the level of support for the EU, as Claes mentioned, you know. Denmark used to be very low and now is high. Britain is off the bottom of the chart. Well, actually not. Britain sits about 20% below the EU average, which is not off the bottom of the chart, and still gives it, in general, most of the time, a level of support, a number of people saying that EU membership is a good thing, which is greater than the number saying that it's a bad thing. An awful lot of people say it's neither good nor bad. So there's a huge difference in the level of support. But in terms of the pattern, in terms of the rise and fall, and in terms of the 80% decline in the parallelogram, that's exactly the same across countries. There is no significant difference from one country to the next in the pattern of response or in the pattern of rise and fall. They're all responding to the same signals.
Yeah, I had the point that John made about the causal responsibility, and I think that's very important also if you think about the benchmark, what national governments are doing. And I think in some ways, of course, Alan Millward, not to go fully into governmentalist today, but, you know, also argues that smaller nations like Denmark or the Netherlands have actually gained in sovereignty. So what would have happened if the financial crisis would have hit these countries if they were not inside the EU? Certain people talk, you know, about Switzerland or about these other cases, but we fundamentally don't know that, right? So I think in terms of if you try to answer the causal responsibility question, you actually see as you know, in certain countries, actually it tracks very similarly, although there's differences in the levels between national and European. They're, you know, national European similar in the kind of good governance countries, and then the EU is higher in the bad governance countries, but they track quite similarly over time. So there's equal kind of responsibility also given to national governments, and especially what you do see some variation, at least in trust decline, that in the south it's especially also hitting the national governments rather than the EU. And, you know, that's something to, I think that's a fundamental question that we don't necessarily know, because we don't know how it would have been if these national governments were by themselves. Right?
No, I just wanted to reflect for 10 seconds on the U.S. intervention and say that not only do you point to the very important matter of the cross-national variation, both in terms of elite support, public opinion, and, say, media coverage and public discussion of EU matters, but you also brought up an interestingly positive note by bringing in yet another benchmark or another yardstick. It all depends. And despite the fact that many people thought it was hard to get a budget in the EU, I guess it can still be worse, and that's just what I wanted to add on. Thank you.
So I think we should certainly thank Claes for nevertheless, even though I thought there was a convergence on a slightly more pessimistic diagnosis, so ending on a more positive note. I think perhaps what we were a bit short on today is sort of solutions to the extent that there is one, but I should say, you know, buy the book and it's there in the conclusion. But that's maybe also a bit optimistic.